know for personal experience that VR can help with things like phobias. I treated my own vertigo for flights and so on using a virtual reality system. And so things like exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral modification techniques to treat alcohol addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder of veterans, that's been literally been done for like 3 or 4 decades now. All these specific targeted surgical intense experiences that VR can offer because it's embodied. It's literally the first digital format that triggers and hijacks the autonomic nervous system into believing that the experience is real. It's just so fascinating that you can doing it right in the proper conditions can actually let you transcend and overcome something that otherwise you don't have the opportunity to deal with or treat or feel comfortable enough to look for it.
Welcome to Third Culture Therapy, a podcast that looks at the unique ways our social identity and cultural heritage impact our mental and emotional well-being. I'm Leila Maghribi, writer, journalist, and host of this show. Hello, listeners. Today's episode takes us to the frontier of some of the tools being created for cognitive disorders in this conversation with the founder of a virtual reality company. Amir talks about harnessing VR and tech for better health, despite his dislike of the metaverse. He also shares his nostalgia for an ancient Iran and why it's sometimes important to question everything about yourself. So who is my guest? Amir Bozorgzadeh is co-founder and CEO at VirtuLeap, a startup that unlocks neuroscience with virtual reality to help increase attention levels and address cognitive illnesses, disorders, and learning challenges. Before VirtuLeap, Amir founded Game Guys, a mobile game studio based in Dubai, and Time Dirham, the first social impact startup to introduce time banking to the Middle East. He is an alumni of York University and Think School of Creative Leadership. Amir has been a contributing writer to tech blogs like VentureBeat and TechCrunch on the topics of emerging tech, spatial computing, and startup ecosystems. Welcome to the show, Amir. It's great to have you on. I hope I didn't mess up your surname too badly. Apologies if I have.
Total pleasure being on here with you, Leila. No, I think there's like 1,000 variations of that last name. And I discover a new one every day. I think you've done a very, very nice job.
Great. I'm very happy to hear that. So we haven't really had like a techie on the show yet. So I'm quite excited to get into that in more detail and how you see it helping with sort of mental and emotional well-being and how we can harness it. But before I get into that, and kind of tied into my introduction to you, can you tell me where you're from and what cultures hold the most influence over you?
I come from a family of immigrants to Canada. We came from Iran. Right at the end of the Iraq War, Vancouver was basically where I grew up most of that time. It's a suburban area of just older adults and kids and police officers in shorts. It was a great place to grow up, but my upbringing really is very much one of feeling Canadian through and through, growing up with a lot of Canadian culture, yeah, but people from the West Coast of Canada, we really do watch a lot of the content that the United States brings out. And so people do say that a Vancouverite is kind of like a West Coast, very similar to people from Northern California and LA. I left Canada around the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, lived in Dubai. And then for about 8 years, I was there, mobile games publisher, market researcher, did some stints of social impact startups. And then since 2015, 2016, I've been based in Europe.
And what about your connection with Iran? Obviously, you said that your parents left during the Iraq War. And you, what sort of tie, if any, do you feel that you have to Iran?
I kind of investigated that when I was in Dubai. I had the opportunity to visit Iran Once a year minimum, just because if I stay any longer than that and things like military conscription come into play. So I'm very careful to make little small stints in which I try to see if my imaginary sense of nostalgia is actually reality. And my experience was actually one in which it was quite difficult to go back there. I realized that Canadian software in my head, really kind of stuck me out. I tried quite a bit to even professionally work with the startup communities there. It seemed like me and that culture and its current form, we really do not blend together. And my nostalgia doesn't really exist in the current version of Iran. I think it really lies with the history of it, the influences that are still seeping in from the likes of 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, when I read or study personages like Rumi or Hafez or the great epic works like Ferdowsi's Rostam poetry. Like, these are the things that I feel pulled towards. But when it comes to the current culture, in fact, I think its immune system rejects me.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I loved also the example of, like, you have this software, the Canadian software, because I do understand very much what you mean by that. When I answer the question of where I'm from, I give all of the countries. But when I break down who I am, I often describe myself as having like a British mind, like a British mental system, because I was born and raised here. And that's, to put it in your words, like, that's the software that I have governing my thinking and the way that I approach issues, perhaps even my communication. But when it comes to maybe a sort of spirit and a temperament, then I kind of go more into the Middle Eastern side. So it's like I have these two elements kind of playing in. I also think it's really very intriguing and very relevant how you mentioned this nostalgia for a place that I think is very common with people who don't tend to have the regular connection. And I mean the physical connection with a place. They know they're from somewhere, and they have that sort of idea of the background. But then with that, in the absence of having these regular visits and interactions, you create this other vision, or not another vision, you create a vision. For you, it's going back actually, thousands of years in time. And I wonder how much of that is also in part because you're kind of trying to look at something really beautiful about a place that perhaps doesn't really get the best, reputation in day-to-day coverage of Iran, which is very unfortunate. I have been lucky enough to visit once only Tehran, though, and it is an incredible country. Does that sort of resonate at all with you?
Yeah, it's one, this thing about nostalgia. I think on one hand, I feel that it's the process of being a youth and getting experience in your imagination meeting reality, and that process of tasting real experiences, making mistakes, having your ideas challenged. That's a process that takes time, and I feel some of that nostalgia was simply naivety. Another side of some of that is I still have this growing interest. I've had it for a while, but I feel even in neuroscience or biological research, we have this suspicion that our ancestors, a lot of the deeds and things that happened, the traumas of our grandfathers and grandparents from a long way back, actually does have a residue in you. And I just can't get rid of that, suspicion that nostalgia, or maybe I'm just hoping for it, that it still has a lingering something in me that pulls me towards that place, something epigenetic, something, mm-hmm. something beyond our scope, because we think we're the end of history. We always mm-hmm. think we're the brilliant people that have no more things to be disillusioned about. Our science is the best, but in 50 years or 100 years, will we realize that in fact, that nostalgia that you have, that lingering emotionality towards, you know, history, is there a connection? And maybe it's a little too spiritual of an angle, but that does linger in me, that I can't understand why I'm so pulled. And the more ancient that locality, I'm talking about Assyria too, I'm talking about Mesopotamia, I am very drawn to that region, and I do not know why.
Right. So where would you, how would you describe your relationship now with Iran?
And I love that you call it Iran. Well, you would call it Iran because that's what it's called now. But, you know, a lot of people call it Persia. And I remember reading that the reason we call it Persia was actually because back in the days of the Achaemenid Empire, Cyrus the Great and all those folks, so where Iran was a dominating force in the world, the Greeks were submitting at certain points to that regime. And the Achaemenid Empire was actually located in the province of Pars, and then they would call them the Persians, but it's always called Iran. But to me, Iran and my connection to it is the greater region of where that culture actually mm-hmm. really extended. It was much larger. I mean, Iraq would be connected to what I considered my nostalgia to Iran. I look at this current, you know, contracted version of what it is now, and what happens from the Greek invasions to the Mongolian invasions to the Islamic the entrance of this Islamic influence, and the fleeing of those Zoroastrians to India, you know, all of that really plays a part to me. And I don't feel connected to what it is in the map now. I feel connected to that fuller region.
Yeah, no, I understand what you mean. Yeah. There is also some nostalgia in that, right, as well, like harking back to a time when, of a time of great power, influence, and unity, which I think, regardless of where you're from, that's going to be appealing, right? We would all love to be powerful, unified, and influential, I think. And I also think it's very tied in with how people feel about themselves and their cultures today, and that, you know, there's the nostalgia, and the other side of the coin to that is quite deep sadness and longing, and maybe a little bit of sort of melancholy about, you know, something that's been lost, especially when we look at the state of play today and we see, you know, let's be, you know, let's call a spade, the region is overwhelmingly in a bad state, you know, bar a couple of pockets of exceptional growth and development, overall, this is a declining period. And so I think that can often, I see it, especially in the older generation, this like longing for something that once was, that no longer is. And with it, there is quite a deep pain that I recall, you know, really witnessing with my parents a lot. And that was difficult, I think, to on the one hand, you're like, yes, I want to come out and be proud of my culture and what it had. But at a certain point in my sort of growing up years, I was a bit like, we can't just keep going back to the past to kind of confirm that we have this capacity and this capability. Like, what are we going to do now? So I do think that ties in with a lot of people's difficult mental, emotional state of being. You share a lot. I know you've got a very big following on LinkedIn, and you write, but you also share a lot of articles related to mental health. And I wanted to ask you, where's your interest in this common? How and why are you interested in it?
I just can't imagine what's more important than these topics. You try to figure out why you're interested in certain things. What is it that extracts meaning for you. If you don't have that meaning, then at least for me, that's what will cause a depression or maybe indefinite escapism, you know, I think, which is really quite common now with at least the young people that I run. I'm saying young people as if
I'm the suddenly, youth.
gosh, I just aged myself in that moment. The young people, but the people I talk to who are less in their 20s and so on, we have festival culture, which is so exhilarating. These festivals where people come together and they try to create and enter into a different set of rules that are full of much more liberty, and they can bend you know, the rigid ways of the cold way that they feel like the world is currently is, you know, increased competition constantly, increased feeling of scarcity. Create your own kind of advantage and then make sure you can like isolate everyone from taking that advantage from you. It's a very difficult time, I feel, to foster your own sense of identity and keep it unique. But keep it loving and open and all these things transparent. And so I'm very interested about the neurosciences. I'm interested in sociology and the nostalgia of the past. I guess I look at alternate systems that once were, where you have like Sarmatian and Scythian Iranians horseback riding, where women and men are equal warriors hand in hand, where you have Cyrus the Great one of the first I guess historical accounts of a, you know, charter for human rights, abolishment of slavery. You see these things, like you said, in some of these regions now in decline, but at one point they were at a height, and that's a cycle that we see. But maybe we can draw information and examples of ways of being that we don't have to feel so isolated. I guess everything I share on LinkedIn or these kinds of researches that I'm so, you know, fascinated about it, it's because it relates to just another piece, maybe a clue that can help me navigate out of any sense of not feeling potentials and opportunities for this moment. What can help me liberate, and what can help other people liberate, not feeling held down by the current situations we're in? How can we just feel that same childlike, you know, gusto for life?
I feel like we're similar in the sense of looking at the past and drawing from history to try and find our way forward. I'm a big believer in you can't really understand where you're going until you know sort of where you've been, and you do have to understand that, and you have to look at everything in its context. Otherwise, if we just take parts out, well, it's just rife for misinterpretation and abuse. I want to say, I mean, it's a bit of a harsh word, but I do think to a certain extent, yes. We're not really learning, really, if we're not taking stock of what we've done before, what worked, what didn't. You're very intrigued by the past and the ancient past to a large extent, and yet you're in a field that is super avant-garde and very much of the future, and that's the tech world. But not only tech, we're talking about virtual reality. I think it's very interesting how you, and I'll get you to sort of describe more what Virtue Leap does, but you're harnessing tech to try and potentially help with certain cognitive learning difficulties and other perhaps mental health issues. But at the same time, I think you might agree with me that tech does have a bit of a bad rap for potentially causing a lot of these issues, whether it's our poor attention span, anxiety, depression. So where do you stand on that? And maybe perhaps to take it back a notch, like, can you describe Virtue Leap yourself and what its aims are?
Yeah, sure. I you know, I happen to have fallen into this path where I run this company, this startup that leverages virtual reality and tries to use it for very specific purposes of helping people with cognitive disorders, or helping people reclaim some of their you know, sustained attention skills that TikTok is literally stealing from us right under our feet. I think technology is a very double-edged sword, especially when it comes to the frontier side of things, virtual reality, AI, all these buzzwords. I'm not a fan of the other side of the coin, where they take it away as much, I think, as they potentially, or at least promise to give. So we have to be, I think we have to be very careful with technology. I think virtual reality can cause traumas just as much as it can help us cure them potentially. It's all about how we craft them and how we design them and how we really, really think it through when we implement them. And a lot of the people and my peers in this kind of sector, they don't give a crap about that, right? I don't think they do, not because they're bad people or anything, but because everyone in the tech world and the VC, venture capital backed world, everyone's in a frenzy from just move from one trend to the other trend, and everything is just accelerating 1 year after the other. I don't think we're controlling it. I think in many respects, it's controlling us. You know, you have some disaster and have a bunch of us randomly put into a cave together. None of us can create a microprocessor or any of this stuff. I can't even create a fire, you know? So I don't think it's improving us fundamentally. I think we're just, you know, just playing around with these toys and trinkets. But in some cases, and I hope that what Virtual Leap is all about is being one of those companies that sees the value in using a technology to overcome something that for whatever reason has beset you. So ADHD, not being able to pay attention for long periods of time. I mentioned TikTok. It is literally, there's a term called TikTok brain that's being studied now. I don't think a lot of us can even pay attention for longer than 30 seconds anymore because of these kinds of gamified mechanisms that are running rampant without any regulation. It's going to lead to what I consider a cognition crisis. And the only way I'm using VR is to hope combat that. But at the very same time, I know there's virtual reality experiences that can probably do even worse than what TikTok is doing right now. So I walk this fine line, not very popular amongst a lot of people in this field, because I do in any conference or a podcast, I will always share that side, which is, you know, it's we're still playing with fire.
Yeah. So why did you enter the space if you're so skeptical about it and you're quite concerned about the potential negative impacts? Like, what drew you to this?
I know for personal experience that VR can help with things like phobias. I treated my own vertigo for flights and so on using a virtual reality system. And so things like exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral modification techniques to treat alcohol addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder of veterans, that's been literally been done for like 3 or 4 decades now. All these specific targeted surgical intense experiences that VR can offer because it's embodied. It's literally the first digital format that triggers and hijacks the autonomic nervous system into believing that the experience is real. It's just so fascinating that you can, doing it right in the proper conditions, can actually let you transcend and overcome something that otherwise you don't have the opportunity to deal with or treat or feel comfortable enough to look for it. I entered this space because I know when it comes to something like a cognitive disorder, a cognitive challenge, I know it creates a controlled environment that can really help address. I'm not going to say treat or solve. I really don't, you know, we're so in the frontier that we don't have the historical, you know, vantage to know if it's permanent or, you know, if something comes back. But it does seem to be very exciting for these specific things, but just very carefully used for a short period of time. I don't want anyone going into anything called the metaverse. I literally would be happy if that word was never used again in my presence. I think, are you having problems going out into the real world? Do you have solutions for that? Maybe not. VR makes accessible to anybody as long as they have it, you know, as they just need this device. Anybody can have the best of class therapeutic solution. And I think that's what it promises.
So is your company, is virtually mainly focused then on cognitive functions and treating potential cognitive disorders, or is there going to be a more expanded use of your products? And I guess my question is sort of like, are you a health tech company or more tech that does a little bit of health related work?
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, we're a schizophrenic company in the early stages of it. You know, you kind of go, I'm leaning towards education and wellness. And then at the same time, I'm like, I got these partners like MIT that are really interested in maybe more more critical applications, like, you know, a healthcare use case, or running a clinical study for Alzheimer's disease, usually running a clinical study for something very, very serious, like even long COVID, or people who do who are rehabilitating from a traumatic brain injury, or are doing chemotherapy. They might have something that's a memory impairment. In those cases, they're serious, and we always make it accessible to partners to work with them on clinical studies, and that will always happen. In fact, the software that we have created, Enhanced VR, it's already available on the consumer app stores for free. We make it available because we just don't make any medical claims, but it's available to people. And my biggest interest is to allow our solutions to be available to students in high schools. A gym for the mind, very, very general, broad-based. That's how it is actually designed right now, even though we have all these trinkets and enterprise sort of tools that allows clinical partners to use it for more serious use cases.
I see. So tied to that, and something that you've released sort of study on, so you have a bit of data to back it up. One of the disorders that is getting a lot of attention recently is ADHD, attention deficit disorder, ADD or ADHD, and virtually released some findings recently about how VR can or has impacted attention for people with ADHD. Could you explain a little bit how and what you discovered from the use of VR for people who do have ADHD?
It's actually one of the most exciting areas where I want our technology to be used. And because during COVID, especially around 2020, 2021, for the FDA in the US especially, it was really interesting because COVID, like many regulatory bodies around the world, they all kind of hurried to facilitate this whole new category of digital therapeutics. Can content be medicine? Can a doctor prescribe a solution instead of a solution that's digital first, rather than prescribing, you know, Ritalin or some drug? When you have attention deficit disorder, does a doctor just immediately get you on drugs? I think that's something that the U.S. is starting to become conscious of as not the first knee-jerk reaction you should do whenever there's something wrong, like immediately prescribe a molecular drug. This study that we ran with P. Porto, it's an institute, neuroscience institute department, part of the P. Porto school in Portugal. We did an initial pilot where we saw in the case of university students with ADHD that they're, by playing our games, our exercises, their processing speed was significantly increased. It's a you know, first step in the direction of validating our solution as a video game, as a prescribable solution by a doctor for people, not just students, anybody with any difficulty in sustaining their attention. Can the games help us train our neuroplasticity to get back into a more disciplined situation in which we can use that instead of a drug, or maybe even combine with the drug to you know, improve even efficacy or improve adherence to that drug. And they were like experimenting all those directions. But the idea is, can we serve in that place to be an aid for people with these kind of issues?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very exciting indeed. But I guess I can't help but wonder that it sounds like you're in a little bit of a catch-22 situation as well, because you are talking about ultimately gaming in one form or another. You are talking about being in an alternative reality, ultimately, which isn't in the real world, whatever that means. And you know, you come also from a gaming background in your earlier company, but you've also said that you're very conscious of the perils of, you know, entering the word that you're not a fan of, the metaverse and the like. So that sounds like a place of tension. How do you manage that?
When we create these, we call them games, but it's kind of funny because they're actually neuropsychological assessment tools that are gamified. Uh-huh. And we call them games to be more catchy, but they're actually measuring sticks. They evaluate your strength in a particular cognitive function. And our 15 activities currently track they test and train 22 different cognitive categories like memory and problem solving and information processing, but also motor control skills, spatial orientation. And the good thing about virtual reality is that it kind of shuts out the external environment, lets you focus. But all the games or exercises are very, very short. They're about 3 minutes each. And we've designed it to be basically a 15-minute experience, kind of like part of your, you know, daily or weekly healthy routines. Come into the gym for the mind, play those three games, see how you're scoring. Are you been sleeping badly and you can see drops? And, you know, use your data in that way. But they are not designed to maximize session length. We're not trying to make things addictive. On the contrary, what's funny about it is that people typically like some of the games because they're games that relate to their cognitive strengths, and they loathe the games that are touching on their Achilles heel. So right. It's not just kind of like some games are pleasurable, but some are like, it's like brushing your teeth.
Right.
But you have to ultimately know it's good for you. Okay. To at least know. So you're right. There's a fine line, and we're always under threat of contradicting ourselves when you're walking that kind of stage. My hope is that as this technology keeps on getting better and better, we'll move these activities outside of virtual reality to what I hope to see the augmented reality devices, the ones that, you know, you're digital experiences kind of interpenetrate with the real world. You're not shutting yourself purely into a virtual world, because I do agree that's kind of like an intermediary step in which this technology is kindly sitting and residing in. But eventually we're going to have kind of these lenses or glasses with these activities more kind of blending into our world rather than completely taking us out of it.
I don't know if this is a silly example, but when you described it, it reminded me of when I was at school and we had these computer programs to teach us how to touch type. And it was basically like a sort of game thing. And, you know, had a timer and words would pop up and you would just have to type. And then, I mean, now I can type out like whole pages with my eyes closed because I'm just very good at touch typing. But I learned all of that at school through this program that was like a game. But if I think back, I did it and then I learned what I needed to. I never really felt afterwards like, ooh, let me open this game again to practice how fast my typing skills are. So yeah, it sounds a little bit like that.
Was that like the same one, like quick as Zoe, what stops x-rays? You know, did you memorize with these things? Because put the same things and I've never heard someone else remember that. I remember it very well.
Yeah. It was great. I mean, it was really great, actually. Like now, if I think of my, because I was the only one in my family who did that. Mm-hmm. I guess my sisters are older. Maybe they didn't have that at that time. And yeah, the way in which I can type compared to them is It's just a completely different thing. But again, it was for its use specifically. And even though I did find it a little bit fun at the time, I didn't think to then continue with it. Although granted, virtual reality and the offerings now are much more perhaps attractive to people who do want to escape into an alternative universe.
It's a really good example. It's how I want to see it. I feel like if someone wants to escape reality, that's when technologies are used in the wrong way, you know, and I don't think you were trying to escape reality by learning to type those games. You know, you were, even the game had a special mechanism in mind and you kind of submitted to it. And now, like me, you can't explain why your fingers know those places. It, for some reason, it accelerated it through something and you had to submit to an experience that was digital, but it was about making something transfer into a skill in your real world. And I hope that's what VR can do. It can help us transfer skills in VR and especially controlled environment back into walking into forest and living real life. You know, I never want VR or metaverse to be an alternative or be a place you spend too much time for. I think it should help us live our real life better. And I think that example is a really good one.
It's great to hear that you don't want people to be seeking this alternative existence in the virtual world. However, going back to tension and culture, the topics of both tension and culture, you know, you are in a space, the tech sphere and virtual reality, that's very hot. And in a space, or let's just say generally in tech and in entrepreneurship, we're talking about increasing always the use of a product by the customers. And the most valuable thing anyone can get from us as humans is our attention and our time, right? So, you know, ultimately these companies and financiers behind them would like, I presume, for more people to be spending more time in these spaces. How does that sit in with your own ethos? And how do you navigate this culture where within the tech entrepreneurship world, there is this desire for actually greater consumption? And you're kind of advocating for like really limited consumption. Yeah. How do you manage that as, you know, as a founder, as a CEO, as a person occupying this space? And ultimately, it is a culture, right? The VC world and the tech startup world is a culture in and of itself.
First and foremost, I am not popular outside of the sphere of neuroscientists and geeks and nerds. They're the people who like me and I like them, you know, mutually. For some reason, I'm thinking right now, again, about an ancient culture. I remember studying ancient China. And I remember that they, in the status classes, they considered the merchants below the farmers. They were very low. They were like on the bottom rung of the social class system. Anyone who's making profit for profit's sake. It was always, if you're not a creator of something, if you're not making something with creativity or with your hands, then, you know, you're the lowest of the low. And that's kind of how I see VCs right now in a certain way. Even founders who turn into investors, I don't think they understand the principle of neuroplasticity. You become what you do. It doesn't matter if you did X, Y, and Z at, you know, 20 years ago, if you're for now every day just focusing on investing to making a profit. And I know some people are much more mission driven than that. But in my experience of having dealt with hundreds of VCs, it's very hard for me not to believe that they really just care about the Excel sheets and quantifying human souls into those Excel sheets. The VC model is a very, very dangerous one when you couple it with wellness and healthcare and social impact sort of use cases. It's really only good, I think, when you couple it with consuming models, you know, consumption models, like you say, selling hot dogs online or whatever versions of that, where they give you money, they want you, who has taken their money, to exhaust all that money within an 18-month period in which you raise even more money and you try to create a hockey stick, you know, curve of like, you know, crazy success. And I won't go into why they do that. It makes total sense that they do it that way, but then they try to apply that same model into areas that you should not force people to go work faster than best practices and regulatory rules, checks and balances have been set up for good reason. You see a lot right now, and we're going to see more and more, I'm sure, of founders being caught lying and doing things that are criminally offensive. Theranos is a very good example, but blaming the founder there, I think, is the same thing society always does. They try to scapegoat it. They don't go backwards and go, actually, the overarching VC culture was what promoted that to happen in the first place. It's about faking it till you make it. And that's great, I guess, for the movies and Netflix specials. But in reality, nothing is more harmful for society than this type of mentality. And what do I say? What can I say? It's the powers that be that force this upon us. And if you can bootstrap as a company founder, then always do that first. I've learned the hard way that that's the best way to go about it. If you can avoid getting any venture capital money, then do it. But typically in the world that we live in, the startup culture, it's extremely hard to survive without raising money, unfortunately, because we have to live in the system that exists.
Yeah, absolutely. I think really good points that you raise, especially about the wellness space and the tech and like the marrying of this in the VC world, because wellness has become so hot in the last few years. And on the one hand, as someone who cares a lot about people's wellness, I think, yay, that's cool. More people know, there's going to be more awareness, maybe more avenues for people to seek help, destigmatization, all of that. But as you rightfully have raised, there's a lot of room for some nonsense to happen, to put it crudely, you know, some really shady business, some quick fixes. And I think one of the most important lessons that I have learned when it comes to my own mental and emotional well-being, and something that I tell people often when I can see that they're struggling, is that it takes time. It takes time. And there is no real shortcut. There are things you can do to help you every day so that you're not constantly in a state of, you know, gripped by anxiety or depression or whatever. But ultimately, the healing, the real reprogramming, the changes that you will invariably need to make take time. The realizations also take time. So for anyone, you know, trying to get into a space to think that, the path to wellness can be with two clicks of a button and like purchase this item or download this thing, that's instantly my sort of alarm bells go off with that. And I do think there's actually a lot of capacity to do more harm than good. But circling it back to the startup world, so the startup world is your world. It is kind of your culture. And you've just said that you've relayed a few issues that you have with it. So how do you personally, as Amir, as a founder, how do you maintain your own balance in a space and a sphere that you're obviously very passionate about, but that you can see fundamentally there are some maybe disconnects with the way that you think? What do you do for yourself to keep yourself centered, to keep yourself balanced, to be like, no, this is the way I'm going to go and how I'm going to manage and deal with people?
As a startup founder, it's really precious to have a co-founder, someone you trust. You didn't just pair with them in some program. No, someone, ideally, this is like really a lucky that I have one. Hossein is my co-founder and business partner for 15 years. I share everything transparently. You need someone to speak sanely to in the midst of so much shrouded kind of half sincerity, you know. You need real connections in your life, your partner, you need, social structure. All the neuroscience research says, you know, have a good physical workout regularly, have a good social structure of people you can speak real to. I mean, these are just things you need in your life. There, a lot of founders put all their identity in being a founder, and I couldn't reject that idea more. I think what you do for your job, as much as you can, make it something connected to passion, for sure. But at the end of the day, you have to have some detachment of your identity away from that. The outcome of your job or your profession or your startup cannot be intrinsically tied and connected to your sense of self. Your sense of self has to be overarching that. It has to be detached and willing to laugh at it even. You should be able to laugh at a lot of things. When we get too obsessive and we start attaching our identity to things, that's when things get really awry, go into dangerous territory. And whatever you do in your life, if you have philosophical and psychological interests, then pursue those as morning rituals. Do whatever you got to do uniquely to you that works for your special way of navigating this treacherous land of psychological, like, you know, performance in the world, where if you don't live up to it, you just panic. Nothing could be more insane than falling into that delirium. And so that's how I see it. I just do not believe fully in my company in that way. I know I'm doing good the way I want to do it, but it's not something that I'm going to become, you know, a megalomaniac about.
That sounds like a really healthy and balanced way to approach something that could easily, as you mentioned, be taken in a different direction. How did you get to that point? Is that just been your sort of ethos in life, or did you learn this from your previous companies? Was there something that took you here, or brought you here rather?
You know, I've always more or less been drawn to the value of self-doubting. You know, we kind of come out of the woodwork of life and school and upbringing of parents and teachers and all these early impressions, and we kind of construct this persona. I use this word from a Carl Jungian sort of frame, where you create this mask, and that mask is your it's your connection, it's your interface with the world of work and relating to, you know, the pop culture and living in these times, making a living, finding however that is, and at the same time being able to do what you want to do, and all of that is great. But I find a lot of it, it's constructed based on other people's you know, personas. We absorb things and then we install them without actually evaluating and breaking them out. By the time we're teenagers, we're already just basically a construction of other people. And so there's a certain time you have to, like, have your own little second education, a second education or period in which you start dismantling yourself.
Yeah.
And that's always been my passion since university. And I think 17, 18 years old, I started that kind of quest. And that quest has always been something I never speak about. It's not something I share. It's just my thing. I've never been that person who believes you need to share too much about that part of you. That's your psychological realm. You deal with it. But I've always been suspicious about myself and what I think is myself.
So you're always questioning. Is that you're always questioning yourself and where certain thoughts or actions or behaviors come from, and then you kind of put them under a bit of a microscope. Is that right?
Exactly. And you have to find whatever, you know. I went through all these different experiences of even programs, you know, spending money and time doing something other than going to a vacation just to, you know, to have fun. I think we need to have things in our lives that allow us to question if we think what we think because we think it, or because we're just kind of drawing from something that was given to us ready-made.
Yeah, if we're just operating out of like a pre-programmed software or an app, you know, to use modern day lingo, that's already, you know, been downloaded, as opposed to something that is of our own volition. And I completely relate to that way. I definitely feel like I've spent most of my life in that questioning realm. And I don't think I actually realized that that was a bit abnormal until a few years ago, because I've just always sort of put some of my, well, not some, all of my thoughts under a microscope. I still do, but I think with less angst now. I think before, and I think that comes with some confidence and experience. I think before I was just a bit too in the question zone. And I, without having a solid sense of trust in yourself, that can take you down a spiral. As I've developed more trust and confidence within myself, I still do go through that questioning, like, okay, Leila, are you thinking this because you really think this? Like, or because society or your parents or your previous experiences are influencing? And even if they, even if the answer is yes, doesn't mean I would discount it. I may still be like, yeah, and I'm happy with that. You know, I'm happy to take that on board, but I feel like I'm coming at it with this, you know, this, it's awareness, but it's also a more of a free will. I think I really dislike the idea that I am being pushed and guided by things that aren't of my making and choice. Now, ultimately, that's going to happen regardless, right? Because there's too many things that have gone on, and I'm not going to spend my life just digging inside trying to unpick all of that. But I think having that degree of discernment, I think it's really a lot about it. A lot of it is, I love the word discernment, which is not really saying something is good or bad, but it's really just putting this critical lens on a situation, on a person even, and coming at it with, I guess, a higher form of consciousness, maybe.
Consciousness, yeah. is a good word, I think. Self-awareness, but consciousness is a really perfect word, I think. It's, are you aware of it happening? Can you, you know, it's just sometimes if we're not conscious at a little bit extra degrees of you know, turning on that light, you know, there's a lot of chemical processes that can't happen if you have light there. You know, a lot of things can fester and mold can appear in ways that that are not good for you if you don't have that level of awareness of it. It's not that things are right or wrong, but at least you can put that consciousness, as you say.
Yes, 100%. Great analogy with the light, because that applies very much when it comes to mental, emotional health, putting a light on things. Like they say, you know, when you put a light on something, it removes the shame. A shame being such a big part of mental health woes. And so when, you know, we talk about awareness and consciousness, sometimes people be like, yeah, okay, fine, I know that happened. Like, why does that help me? It does actually a great deal. Maybe it removes a certain burden and a weight and a heaviness. And then what you decide to do with that afterwards is a different story. What from your own cultures do you think you've discovered have been playing more of an influence on you and your maybe mental, emotional balance than you realized perhaps before when you started looking into it?
I never felt, you know, as a family that immigrates to a country that's so diametrically opposite than the other, you know, you have my parents who are coming with fully indoctrinated, you know, Iranian, Middle Eastern, operating systems. And then you have, like, you know, I'm one of three children, and each one is about 6 years older than the other, and I'm the youngest. So I have the most maximum Canadian, you know, alien operating system. And then my sister in front of me, by, you know, 5-6 years, she's got kind of like a half kind of thing. And then I got the 16-year-old, you know, much older one coming in almost at the end of high school with fully Iranian software in Canada. You know, it's so, and you got this like gradation. And so I'm the most opposite. I've always felt kind of torn between the culture that exists in my household versus the one that I'm really kind of saturated in outside in the world. It's that contradiction. And so maybe that also, now I'm getting psychotherapy mode onto myself right now, but maybe, you know, this explains a lot. No, it's a, I feel like it's always been that feeling torn, feeling that tension, as you kind of use in the other aspect of work. It's that tension, and then I guess I reflect that tension in those searches for navigating myself, navigating the world. I don't think that's unique. I think a lot of immigrants and their children, and then you also have conflicts in those households, right? They can't navigate themselves because you literally have two different opposing cultures in the same household. You know, the enemy from within and the enemy from without, and not saying enemy, the word, but we do get defensive.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, we do get defensive for sure. I think, I mean, just human nature, but then with immigrant families, there's definitely an added layer of defensiveness that comes into play that makes it very hard to be able to have these discussions in a diffused manner and in a let's have this discussion and express. It's just so much emotionality around it. And I think that just creates more barriers and disconnect, because and disconnect by what I mean is that you kind of realize, well, I can't bridge this gap, so I'm going to have to either disconnect from it or disconnect part of myself from it in order to be able to sustain. Because rarely do we decide, or that's it, you know, forget the whole family and that whole makeup. We still have to kind of be with it in some way. How we do that, then, I think there are variations to you know, varied degrees of disconnection, which is a shame, because, you know, growth, I believe, comes in managing to navigate that sticky, icky bit in the middle, where you're both like, no, it's my way. No, it's my way. But you're like, well, actually, maybe the whole point is we're trying to figure out a new way and we can do it together. I'd much rather do it with my tribe, because I do consider my family my tribe, you know, and then without. But often you find that there is, it tends to be the youngest person in the family who goes off and is like, right, I will go off and find the answers by myself. I don't know if you found that was the same in your situation. Sounds a bit like it.
I think we have a lot of similarities across everything. You seem to be more mature about it than how I think I've played it. I sometimes move thousands of kilometers away from the zone of, that activity. And then that cures things, you know, distance always cures it, but then you have time to mature up, get older, experience things, then come back with fresh eyes. And then that, you know, so sometimes you have to have momentary escapes and in a healthy way as much as possible. I've never been one to disown or want to be disowned or anything like that. I think I have examples like that I've seen in families and so on, certain cultures. It's in fact, some horrific kind of dynamics can come into play when you bring Middle East to, or the East in general with the West. And they're so opposite in their foundations and even their current fundamental ways of approaching the economy, work, family units, marriage is a big one. Mm-hmm. And it's fortunate for me that that's never ever been something to happen, but I can see the threat of it. If again, consciousness is, how much consciousness is there of, and how much willingness is there to reconcile and give way, give territory, you know, you know, it's about giving away territory. I guess it all comes down to pride in a certain way too.
I think it's interesting how you say giving territory. Really nice analogy there. But as soon as you said that, I was instantly like, nobody wants to give anything these days though. Everyone's just in like take mode and expand myself, you know, whether it's whether it's we're talking geopolitically or whether we're talking on the individual level.
Right.
And I think you mentioned earlier, right, the scarcity mindset, was it?
Yes.
I think, yeah. And I think it really, again, like ties back into the scarcity mindset that unfortunately humanity at large, and I say overall, but I do see a lot of individuals who don't operate this way. And I take a lot of solace in that. And meeting and speaking with people like you and everybody else I've spoken to on this podcast, but also beyond, there are many, many individuals who don't operate this way. However, as a system, as a system, that is unfortunately the operating system. And that permeates every aspect of life, including trying to, you know, dig inwards and also your relationships with those closest to you, because everyone thinks that this is like a battle where there's only going to be one winner and one loser. And yeah, that's just really not the way to look at it when you're trying to think about inner peace, real growth, love ultimately, because that's what drives me. That kind of what drove me to try and find ways of better ways of communication with my family, with my culture, was that fundamentally I love them, you know, and I want to keep that, sustain that. I want to nourish that. And that does take a lot of work. And I know it's not easy and maybe not so available to everyone, but if we believe in that, then I do see that there are different ways that we can come at it. How do you balance your own today, I suppose, when it comes to where you're at? Yeah, Amir today, and having gone on these various journeys, both professionally, but also geographically, mm-hmm. you live in Spain now. Where do you sit now when it comes to your own balance and inner peace, let's say?
Traveling certainly is important, just so you can be culturally shocked as much as possible. And wherever you come from isn't the model that you just revert to in comparing things. You have to see that there's a lot more out there, and combinations of which cultures do things in a way, you know, ways that hopefully shock you, because shocks are things that can get you out of that territory where you think what's right and what's wrong and how things should be done. All these things that we kind of spoke about of copy and paste sort of things in your perception of the world, even flavors of foods. I mean, we don't realize, like, we, you know, our tastes, what we're used to doing for our routines. And, you know, you need to travel so you can see cultures that do it differently, and they think you're weird that you don't do it their way. And, you know, I think it's a lot of these things that cause conflict and continuous conflict is just little childish things we've held on to that we won't let go of. And it's like just that grip that we have on things and lightening that grip. And again, I've always been kind of fascinated with any techniques or psychological teachings that help us identify that grip and somehow say it's okay to not be, or not to hold on to these things. Like, you just, awareness of that grip is what's hard to find out in the first place. And if you can figure out, like, it actually doesn't matter for you to hold on to that territory. It doesn't actually matter, like, to give that other person the right to be right about something that's actually quite arbitrary. I have a personality that's used to love, and I still have that tendency to want to be right. Yeah. So where does this tendency come from? Do I really care about being right? Yeah. You know, and everyone has that thing or that set of things that they have to go. And do you really, because at a certain age, either you become grumpier and grumpier, or you want to become lighter and lighter.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, Amir, that was such a wonderful conversation. I feel like I could definitely chat with you for hours about all. I feel like, as you said, there's a lot of intersection and familiarity, definitely, with the way that you think. I'm really excited to see what Virtue Leap does next. And I think, I will put details in the show notes about where you can find out more about Amir. Definitely follow him, and his writings are great, and his LinkedIn page shares so much really incredible information. I love to read. Thank you so much for your time. I really enjoy speaking with you.
Thank you, Leila. This is the best way to start my week as well. So thank you for this gift.
Yeah, you're most welcome. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Check out the show notes for more details about my wonderful guests, including where you can find them on social media. If you enjoyed listening to this, please do spread the good word, share with friends, family, cousins, and colleagues, and please, please, please like and leave a review on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast.
Your support is crucial for the show's success, and a couple of clicks from you will mean the world to me. Go to my website, leilamaghribi.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter for more news on future episodes.